Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And my co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report. They'll be joining you for the second and third segment of the program today. And I do have Wendy Wilson joining me for the first part of the program, and she's going to be discussing global cancer laws. So make sure you stay tuned. But first, let's get to the market report for Thursday, October 29th, 2015. And yes, the markets are just kind of a little all over the place. And of course, there was pressure on gold and silver today. Stocks were slightly lower most of the day. They decided to come back a little bit. We'll see where they ended up at. And of course, after the U.S. Said, U.S. government said economic growth slowed more than expected. I guess we're the only ones in this whole country that expects the growth to slow, and maybe we need to inform the government. We can do a better job predicting what the outcome is going to be than they can. But they get to have two opportunities until the end of the year to revise those numbers, of course, and they can't get it right the first time, so they get to adjust them. So even though it's low, we'll be talking about those numbers here in just a few minutes. Let's first go to gold. We have pressure on gold down 9 today at 1147.70. Silver was down 36 at 1568. Platinum was down 9 at 995. Palladium was down 12 at 674. The USDX today was also down 0.32 at 97.28. And with the big run up in crude oil yesterday, we only saw 0.19 negative today, 45.75. Paper markets today, let's see where they ended. Slight pressure, Dow down 23 points, 17,755. The NASDAQ was down 21 at 5,074. S&P basically unchanged, 2089. 10-year yield is moving up 2.17, and that was up 0.08. Euro came back a little bit today, not much, 0.45 at 110. And, it was pretty flat all the way across the board in the foreign markets and the world markets. The Asian markets unchanged. London, Germany were barely down, about the same amount as the Dow, 40 and 30 points. So they told us, the Commerce Department today said the GDP grew at a rate of 1.5% between July and September. and that is compared to a pace of a 3.9% in the second quarter of this year. And the third quarter of 2014, the economy grew at 4.3. So, you know, pretty big drop. But then again, they get to revise it two times before we get the final number. Consumer confidence, that's also rising. And it's a good thing that the American consumers like to eat and drive new cars, because those are the only areas that are showing any strength: restaurants and new cars. So that'll keep the economy going for a long time. As I mentioned, consumer confidence was stronger. We'll see. As long as that stock market is high, as long as it's not tumbling or have any reverse 500-point drops, hey, people out there are happy. You know, seems like that's the only we don't have in an economy. We have a stock market, and that's what fuels the whole world. Before we get to Wendy, the U.S. exports, they declined this year for the first time since the Great Recession. And it's funny, they talk about that it's a troubling trend. It's a troubling trend for big multinational corporations that sell products abroad. Hey, troubling for the multinational corporations. How about troubling trend for the American people? Okay? You have, you know, no more exports in this country since the, you know, it really is incredible. Things are only getting worse, and hopefully we can get a little bit more into this tomorrow. Just thought those things were a little important to bring to you today. The Deutsche Bank lost about $6.6 billion, looking to eliminate about 35,000 jobs. And China looks like they're changing their child policy to where the one-child policy, they're relaxing. Now married couples can have two children. Isn't that great that a government can tell you how many babies you can have? And with that, make sure you tune in tomorrow. We'll discuss some of these, all of these, and more. Tomorrow I'll be here with Alfred Adesk. And for now, we have Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody. I hope our herb signal holds out. It's a little shaky today.
Well, you sound good now.
Awesome. I'm sorry about yesterday. I had a loose connection to my battery, and that was the reason I was stranded at the post office, so my apologies. I thought we'd talk about the global cancer laws that are in the works, if you want.
Sounds great. What kind
okay.
of laws?
Well, a lot of people are maybe not aware, or maybe they don't believe that there's this plan for global health care, and it's being used. And a real clue is when countries have similar laws, and in some instances, almost word for word. So countries which are thousands of miles from the United States are under the European Union's guidelines with regards to therapeutic products and treatment. Yet Europe's laws seem to be influencing congressional laws here in the United States. And you could suspect that this is a very subtle way of incorporating the European Union's harmonization laws for global dominance. And one area of health that seems to be harmonized is in with regards to cancer. So for decades, pioneers in the natural therapeutic approach, Melanie, to cancer couldn't get their research published in the press or in journals. So if the research did get published, editors were choosing the studies that had poor methods of testing and neglected dose range to establish useful doses. However, you know, I think mankind is empowered with information from diverse sources and is made readily available to us all to, you know, help us make choices that we want to make. So the cost of proving that therapy works is pretty enormous. Melanie, let me ask you, do you have a clue how much it would cost to run a clinical trial?
A lot. How's that for an answer?
Yeah, how many zeros can you count, right?
Yeah,
so
really.
If you want a treatment or a therapy to be recognized as effective, you have to play by medicine's rules. And according to Forbes magazine, the cost of a clinical trial can range from $1.3 billion and up. So regardless if the natural therapy works or not, if you don't have the money to prove it by scientific methods, it's not going to be taken seriously, and sharing any information and knowledge about it will be severely discouraged. So any unproven forms of therapy, especially for cancer, are labeled as pseudoscientific or science sometimes regards them as quackery. Now, some of the new terms that patients may encounter, you've heard these, healthcare complementary physicians or integrative medicine. Sometimes these two areas get grouped together with alternative forms of the healing arts. So who do you think initiated combining, lumping these practices, these terms all together to make people think it means the same thing? Got a clue, Melanie?
Why don't you tell us?
Well, apparently it was the White House Commission in 2002. They supposedly, a well-known researcher of complementary and alternative medicine by the name of Dr. Barry Cassell at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center says, according to her, actually there's a critical difference between complementary medicine and alternative. Guess what the complementary integrative treatments are for cancer? Have any idea?
You tell us.
Well, it's antioxidants, vitamins, and herbs.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. So let's get to these cancer acts, and there's a couple of them.
That's what I wanted to bring. I wanted to go back, or where you're starting now, is you talked about how the how all this healthcare, this universal global laws, and with the European Union as far as the leaders and so forth. One of my clients is a doctor, and he's was born in the UK, and he's over here practicing. And prior to passing Obamacare, he told me, he says, that is no different than what we have in the UK and in England. He says, and that is the worst healthcare that anyone can have. And he was really disturbed, and but he was telling me about I mean, he's, it's almost identical, and we know that Obamacare, I mean it just came about within a short period of time, so again it was something that was already designed. And
I
think with these, and real quick, have you heard anything about with these new trade agreements, do they include anything about the...
Well, actually, the universal global health care is really the linchpin to one world order, okay, because health isn't a part of life. It is life. And if you're not on the same sheet of music, you're not going to get treatment and you're not going to get services. So it's one of those twist your arm moments, really. But let's talk about these cancer acts real quick, because it kind of gives people the big picture. As I mentioned earlier, countries with similar laws with regards to healthcare treatments, especially in the area of cancer, in 1939, the UK drafted the Cancer Act, and this blocks patients from receiving unauthorized cancer treatments and information on authorized treatments. So physicians in the UK are threatened with losing their professional standing on their medical register, which is equal to a U.S. doctor losing his license to practice, if they tend to step out outside those boundaries and use any treatments that aren't approved by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, also known as NICE. Now, in 1971, Melanie, President Nixon and the U.S. Congress enacted the National Cancer Act. One of the reasons was it was to create a strengthen the position of the National Cancer Program and create a cancer advisory board. And, of course, taxpayers pay for this. Costs us now $243 million a year. Huge program. Dictates legal cancer treatments in the U.S. Cancer research is presented to the president, and then Congress approves the funds, and taxpayers pay for that. Taxpayers pay again when these treatments move through Medicare and Medicaid. So health authorities promote that we're winning the war on cancer And their main reason is the statistics they publish. They say we've gone from 1 in 5 patients survive their cancer diagnosis by five years to 1 in 3. But really, the average cancer patient survives just 2 years, and I don't call that winning. So the main difference in the UK Cancer Act, Melanie, and the US Cancer Act is that if you live in the UK, you have no access to information involving natural therapeutic alternatives to dealing with cancer. The Minister of Health in the UK prohibits any unauthorized person from communicating alternative therapies which reverse cancer. So there's this total ban on natural cancer cures in the UK unless prescribed by your licensed doctor. And authorities state that the ban is to prevent, you know, patients from being misled on bogus cancer therapies. But, you know, that's, I think, is an excuse because people are pretty rational. They check into things normally before they jump in. So there's this blackout on information which does not come from the scientific community, does not meet the critical and expensive guidelines for clinical trials, and is not administered or authorized by doctors and nurses. So this is a big problem for the people overseas, and this could happen here. They could amend the National Cancer Act here to prevent that. So I would hope Americans would actually stand up and abolish something like that. So here's another problem that the UK people have, like your friend was mentioning to you. With this gag order that's regarding cancer information, the UK people over there are concerned that government may move to abolish their Human Rights Act of 1998. So the British feel that their freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and other fundamental rights are under attack there. So a strong advocate for making changes to the Human Rights Act in the UK is this career politician and a direct descendant from King William IV. His name's David Cameron. He's going to, within the next year, motivate Parliament to replace the Human Rights Act with the British Bill of Rights. Sounds great. Angle is they want to cut the ties with the European Court on Human Rights, which is influencing so many of their laws now. But nobody knows what's in the British Bill of Rights. And that's concerning the Brits. They're nervous. They think they could lose more rights. They're worried that the new laws would impede their right of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom to hold opinions, and to receive and communicate ideas and information without government interference. They're worried that they'll lose these rights under the premise that the new laws will protect their health care and their national security. Does that sound familiar?
A little bit, Wendy.
Oh, well, I don't know if anybody's checked out the United Nations website. If you go to the United Nations website, they have this download. It's called the United Nations in Vienna in Your Daily Life. And on there it says you may not realize just how connected the work of the UN is in Vienna, and it's in within your daily activities. So I encourage people to go down there on that website and download. It's on the United Nations in Vienna. It's the Office of Drugs and Crime. And you've heard of Agenda 21. That name's been batted around. Absolutely. But the UN is really positioning itself to control countries through these various laws in areas of health, community, environment, and business. So they present these laws as if it were in the best interest of the people and in the environment. So they have 7,000 satellites in Earth's orbit, Melanie. 93% of them are registered to the UN. The UN tells us that they are in control of the telecommunications, and you can't check your news, your internet, your phone without them knowing about it. They also claim that they know when you go on vacation, leave to go to the store to shop, or to go to work. They've partnered with the International Atomic Energy Agency to develop global facilities to irradiate food and medical supplies, such as syringes for your flu shots. They claim it kills bacteria, viruses, and insects, but is harmless to you and me. The environmental program, they're involved with that to preserve the environment. And they say if you want, on their website, they say if you want to go hiking or camping, in the mountains, they say you will negatively impact the environment and contribute to climate change. So the slant is you would disrupt the delicate balance, the ecosystem, so you should stay at home.
Stay at home.
Stay in the city. So I could go on. They're involved with the Industrial Development Organization, the Commission on International Trade. They control what foods are in your supermarkets. Okay?
know, Wendy, we're out of time in this segment. Maybe you can continue on that next week.
I know. There's a little bit more, but I think people get the picture. You know, people need to be aware that that's happening, and I think the RF chip is going to be involved with your health care and everything else. So. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Give us some contact information real quick, Wendy.
Oh, sure. They can request a catalog if they want to empower themselves with some natural therapies. 866-229-3663. ThePowerHerbs.com is the website. 866-229-3663. Hey, we have a 20% off coupon that's good through the 1st. It's on the website. Thanks, Melanie.
All righty. Thank you, Wendy, for joining us. And stay tuned, folks. Alfred and James Corbett will be here in just a few minutes.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival. I have just been informed that James is here. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is located in Japan. We're here, and I'm here in Texas, and I don't know where all of you folks are. We record this program on Wednesday evening. It'll be rebroadcast Thursday during the day, in part because... James, it's morning in Japan, and it's relative. You know, it's nighttime here in the year on Wednesday night, and we have to kind of match up our schedules in order to do the reports, do the interview. Hello, James, how are you doing?
I'm here. I'm live. I'm talking to you from halfway around the world. How do I sound?
You sound bad. A little scruffy, but not bad. There was a little bit of static there for a moment. But it is amazing. You know, it's what surprises me. You get into this extraordinary technology. It's not only that we're talking halfway around the world, we're talking for free. How amazing should that be? And yet, once you get it going, we adjust to it right away and we take it for granted. It doesn't astonish us. If we could engage in time travel, we'd be pretty amazed by it for, I don't know, a couple of years maybe, and then it would be just the same old stuff.
Exactly right. Yeah, Louis C.K. has a comedy bit about that. Everything's amazing and no one's happy, where you can get used to things remarkably quickly and fail to realize just what a miraculous thing, time period we're living through, that anyone else in the history of humanity would have been just marveled to even see come to pass. And here we are complaining because our, you know, internet fee is $50 a month or whatever.
Yeah, I understand. Just astonishing. Just really is amazing. We certainly live in interesting times where there are a lot of fantastic, amazing technology available to us, there are technologies available to us. And we also face a bunch of problems, too. We've got a report here from CNBC, and this is today's news. Fed tells markets to wake up. Hike could be coming, and they're talking about an interest rate hike. Not happening today, not happening Wednesday, but maybe in December. Do you think we'll see a rate hike? Will the Fed raise interest rates in December?
Well, I don't see how they can. It doesn't mean they won't, but I don't see how they can. And yet, if they don't, they lose whatever credibility the markets might credit them with, which is not a lot at this point, but still, going from slightly above zero to zero would be something anyway. So they have painted themselves into a corner. I don't know how they plan to get out of that corner, because I don't think they can raise rates. And it's going to be interesting to watch what transpires, unless they just say, once again, well, we're considering it. It'll probably be next year. I guess they can just continue kicking the can down the road. But I really don't see how they're going to be able to paint themselves out of this corner.
They have to be a little amazed. They've been doing this for 9 years, or nearly 9 years, holding interest rates down between 0 and 0.25%. They have to be amazed in their own way. Look, they felt, the public fell for it again. We told them in next month or the month after that. Then maybe we'll raise the rates. It's got to be astonishing to the Federal Reserve that people have gone along with this as long as they have. At least I suppose they should be astonished by it.
Not that I want to make the Fed any more efficient at what it does, because I think it should be abolished and shouldn't exist in the first place. But really, if they were going to try this strategy, what should have taken place is they should have raised the rate by a quarter of a percentage point, maybe 6 months ago or even a year ago at this point, and just held them there for a while so that people get used to the idea that rates can and will go up at some point, but that they're not going to go willy-nilly with it. And I think that would have had something of a calming effect. But all they've done is really primed the pump to the point where now everything hinges on this decision, so that if they even try to move that needle, I think it's going to cause a much bigger effect than it would have even 6 months ago.
But even that's surprising, and it does not bode well. How can it be that a quarter of a percent interest rate is so important that they risk collapsing the economy? That's the implication. I don't think they've said that, but that's the implication. Oh, my gosh, if we raise interest rates by a quarter of a percent, the economy may collapse. That's the implication. How is it possible that China is paying something in the neighborhood of 5% interest right now? Brazil is dealing with 15-16%. They're having problems, but they're getting by. And yet we are worried about a quarter of a percent. Doesn't that indicate that the entire financial structure is so fragile that we can't even raise interest rates by a mere quarter of a percent? Doesn't it tell us we are in great jeopardy right now, or is there?
Well, we certainly are in great jeopardy, and certainly a lot does hinge on this decision. But I think it's less to do with the amount of that change so much as the change itself. I think to go from an environment where it's been at 0 to 0.25 for this long to go in the positive direction by any amount is a signal to the markets of what is to come that I think is more important than the actual amount of the change. And I think once, if that change were to be made and was to work its way through the system, then subsequent changes would not be as big a deal. So it's not the amount of the change so much as just the moving the needle in that particular direction.
Even that is not cause for celebration, because it implies that the market is extremely susceptible to psychological effects. That it doesn't matter, it's just 0.25%. All by itself, the mathematics doesn't count for much, but the psychology may make the markets move up, down, or sideways. Doesn't that suggest there's something fragile? You know, I mean...
I think I hope something that has been exposed over the last 7 years of central bank dictated economic activity or market activity is that just how much the pronouncements of central bankers really do bear on the economy itself, not because they have some sort of magic wand, but simply because the markets really have to price into account what the Fed is doing, because they control the price of the most important commodity, really, if you think about it, in any economy, which is money itself. If money is this instrument that they can create, they can pump in, they can suck out of the economy, they can really manipulate with interest rates, then they get to price. They really are the third person in any transaction that takes place in the entire economy. So I think hopefully this has pulled back the curtain on that, and the fact that the markets really are just trying to predict, be mind readers and try to predict what is the Fed's next move. And I think when people start to really internalize the implications of that, meaning that ultimately the economy is something of a parlor trick that's being, that the wool is being pulled over our eyes rather than actually the result of real economic activity, at least I hope that some people will fall out of that matrix and start to see the system for what it is.
We had a situation with the Federal Reserve back, I think it was early summer, late spring, where Janet Yellen did or did not use the word patient. And markets moved up and down, and almost, you know, we had spectacular effects just on her word choice. Does the Fed want the power to move markets by just their word choice? Will they choose one or two words, and oh my gosh, the market goes up a couple hundred points, goes down a couple hundred points? Do they want that power? Because with that power goes responsibility. Can they speak? Do they dare to speak without parsing every single word, say, oh my gosh, will the people go nuts if I use the word patient? She can't use that? Do they want this power, or would they prefer to be more on a mountaintop where they make pronouncements, and then the word slowly comes down to the public? And most people don't even know what the Fed said until 6 months after the fact. Right now, everybody knows on the day it happened, if not within hours of when it happened.
Right, yes.
Do they want that?
Well, I think a couple of things to note here. First of all, this is obviously not a new phenomenon. The every single pronouncement, every word of the Fed chair has been parsed for decades now, at the very least, and words like irrational exuberance have entered the lexicon because they were uttered by the occult overseer of the economy, Alan Greenspan, back in the 90s and that kind of thing. So it's not a new phenomenon, but it is, I think, part of the war between the ego of some of these chairs and their sense of that they might actually be held accountable for these words. But I think that's really a phenomenon of the psychology of these individual people. As an overall institution, of course, the Federal Reserve, I think, really wants to be in that position of being able to direct the markets where they want them to go by simply making statements, by simply saying words, speaking into existence the economy. I think that's the ultimate dream of central banks, and really what central banks, the promise of central banks has always been, is that we will create this institution which can really oversee the economy and can nudge it this way or that with their words. But as I say, the more they lose credibility and lose face by saying, oh, you know, the rate hike's coming, and it doesn't come, the less markets will let you, really start, will be parsing over every single word. And at some point, I think the lockstep connection there between the markets and what the Fed is saying will break. And at that point, the curtain is pulled, and the Fed doesn't have a lot of tricks up its sleeve at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they're relying on this ability to speak the economy into existence, and once that breaks, I think they lose a lot of their power.
Moving to a different subject, Zero Hedge published an article entitled, "If We Don't Find a Solution Today, It's the End of the European Union. Refugee crisis hits tipping point." Do you think the European Union is being threatened, its existence is being threatened in a meaningful way by the Muslim refugees coming from Syria, Iraq, wherever, that are pouring into Europe?
Well, it is. I mean, it's there's no doubt this is a huge phenomenon, and not just in terms of geopolitically, but obviously economically. I don't see how countries like Germany can take on this many people this quickly and simply just absorb them into the economy, as I think they're hoping to do. I just don't see that happening, and especially in a Eurozone that has been so famously, I think, on fire for years now, and teetering on that flaming edge. Now, with this extra, monkey wrench in the works, I think it's really throwing everything off. So I think there is certainly, I mean, just even from an economic perspective, just looking at the dollar and cents perspective, let alone the impact on human lives, I think there is genuine cause to be concerned here, and how this is going to be, you know, absorbed into an economy that's already quite precarious.
How, if it can't be absorbed, what do you think is going to happen?
It's difficult to make that statement because, again, I think it depends in what particular country this ends up coming to a head, or if if it doesn't happen in one particular country, which countries will be involved and what their situation is. Because, again, as much as the European Union likes to think of itself as a single homogenous entity, of course, it is very much divided, not only along that north-south divide, as I think is quite famous, you know, famously observed, but more specifically, Germany versus everyone else. And I think, you know, those types of things can play into this. So that, I mean, obviously, I mean, if immigrants were flooding into Greece, I mean, that would obviously send things falling in a very different way than if they all end up in Germany. But still, I mean, regardless of how it happens, I think the underlying point is still that, the connected economies of Europe can't really take a shock like this. So I think that the ultimate result of this is going to have to be one of the net negative. And it's only a question, I guess, if the European Central Bank can try to make some sort of, you know, power grab as a result of this by saying, oh, look, the crisis is so deep that now we need the power to intervene more to help out these economies, which, of course, is always the way that they want that to work out. Whether or not they have the political capital to do so might be a different thing.
I can understand that the central banks or the powers that be, whoever, if you give them lemons, they're going to make lemonade. All right, they will. It's Rahm Emanuel and Hillary Clinton saying a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. So I can look at this, and from my perspective, I can see the Muslims coming in from, again, Syria, Iraq, wherever, coming in from the Middle East. Did their refugee status, their invasion, was this orchestrated by the powers that be? Did they make this happen, or did the crisis happen in a way that was unpredictable and unanticipated, but the powers that be say, okay, we got refugees, how do we exploit the situation? Do you see what I'm saying? Did they precipitate,
yes,
or did
yes.
they merely seek to exploit?
Well, I think either way that you look at it, it does come down to the actions that have been taken and the political decisions that have been made at the highest levels in Europe as well as other places, specifically the generation of the refugee problem by the bombing to smithereens of these different countries, which, of course, has been fully, a lot of the European countries have been fully on board with their participation in NATO. So I think regardless of whether it was planned or not, it certainly is the result of decisions that have been made in the power centers of Europe, and I guess you can look at it this way as the chickens coming home to roost. And again, I don't know, I don't have any smoking gun document that they planned to have this refugee crisis, but certainly I think they've been very accommodating of this crisis, and of course they helped to bring it about, whether or not that was intentional. So I think that we can see this as part of a larger game plan that's been unfolding for a very long time to open up borders for these types of you know, unplanned immigration crises, let's call it. And I think this is part of a longer term plan to really destabilize Europe itself. And that's a pretty big claim to make, and probably one that we'll have to go into in more depth.
Well, if we're going to go into it in more depth, why don't we save that until we return from a commercial break? I'm Alfred Adask, here with my guest James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We will be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here in Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett, calling in from Japan, giving us his opinions on geopolitics. And we are talking about the refugees flooding into Europe from the Middle East and speculating on the motives behind the powers that be to cause or at least exploit that refugee crisis. It appears from Zero Hedge if we don't find a solution today, it's the end of the European Union. That's one of the headlines at Zero Hedge. Is it that serious? Is the European Union being threatened? And if so, why would the powers that be want to collapse the European Union?
Yes, a very good question, and I think that the plan is not to collapse the European Union in that sense, at any rate. Perhaps I think the fear that is being spoken to here is more one of native Europeans, you know, fearing the collapse of European culture or European civilization or something along those lines. But I think the European Union as an institution is going to survive this, you know, whatever comes of it, in whatever way. And I think that's more the point. I think the institutional power remains, even if the cultural ties are loosened or weakened or whatever happens at the sort of lower levels of this. And I think that's something that we need to think about when it comes to this. But there's a lot of different ways to look at this situation and the way that it's been fostered. For example, something that played out when this crisis started was Italy giving a lot of these refugees temporary visas, which they knew would be used by these refugees to transit through Italy in on their way into the Eurozone. And because of the European Schengen area, the common customs area, they can travel anywhere. Once they get that toehold in Europe, they can travel anywhere. So Italy was basically saying, all right, fine, if you're coming here, you might as well go on through. And that really facilitated this movement that's taking place. So rather than Europe having a shared, you know, one border kind of mentality here to try to see the problem at its beginning and to try to create some sort of shared strategy for it, basically just one country just offloads it onto the next country. And we've seen how that's played out in some of the transit corridors that these migrants are using. So with all of that in mind, again, what the answer, quote unquote, the solution that comes to mind as a result of this is, well, of course, well, we need a shared border strategy. Why isn't one in place? Well, we need more power to do that. So again, I think the institution actually ends up benefiting from these types of problems that are created at the lower levels of the bureaucracy. And that's why, you know, whatever this is doing culturally or societally there in Europe, I don't think it's the European Union as an institution that is ultimately going to suffer from this.
You're arguing, if I understand correctly, that by allowing these refugees to flood into Europe, they're going to actually tend to diminish the national borders that still exist to some extent in Europe. They're going to weaken, the nation of Germany will be weakened, the nation of France will be weakened, and so on. But out of that chaos, the New World Order will set up a European Union that has borders, regional borders, that are stronger and than they have in the past. But the argument here is that it's the national entities that are going to be ruined, or at least damaged, impaired, changed by the influx of refugees. Is that true?
Yes, I think that's the way to look at it, because if you look at the sort of propaganda that the European public has been subjected to for decades now about, you know, Europe, a shared, united Europe, it hasn't been very effective. They had a big 50th anniversary celebration back in 2007, I believe it was, for the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome, which at the time, no one referred to that as a European Union. No one was thinking of it in those terms. It was just a minor sort of, you know, trade agreement. But it, of course, now it's looked back on, well, that was the beginning of, you know, the European project as we know it today, hatched, of course, by the way, at Bilderberg in 1955. We have the documents to prove that now. But that being what it may, you know, no one basically showed up for those festivities. It's not like the European peoples think of themselves as European so much as they think of themselves as French or German or Italian or what have you. And I think that shows, that speaks to the lack of ability of the sort of political process to move people past that nation state mindset, which of course is going to be an incredibly integral part of this new world order globalist system that they're trying to bring into place. How can you ultimately break down those walls? You need a crisis, just as World War I made the environment for a League of Nations, or World War II made the environment for a United Nations, or other things that would have been unthinkable before that kind of cataclysm. So too, a refugee crisis can change people's opinions. Well, of course, we need a shared border strategy to stop this from happening again. And so it can really serve to break down those types of ingrained cultural and practices and ideas that people still believe in. And if you don't have a crisis, you can't offer the solution.
Does this crisis, we're going to have a crisis. The crisis typically, I mean, to my mind, will require a common enemy. All right, we could have Gore, if I remember his name correctly, coming down out of the spaceship, the robot back from whatever, I don't even remember the name of the movie, but out of the 50s. We need that common enemy, and then we all come together. If that were the way they're thinking, the common enemy in this situation that would unite Italy, France, Germany, the common enemy would be the Muslims.
Yeah.
If that were true, are the Muslims being played? Are they being lured into traveling into European countries in anticipation that one day we're going to say, all right, what, kill them all? If they
I don't think the ultimate answer is going to be kill them all, but I think that certainly that it is kind of, you know, the Europeans versus refugees is becoming the narrative that everyone is at least acknowledging, whether or not they subscribe to that, they're certainly acknowledging that that is the narrative that is causing, that the tension is centering around right now. So all of these, of course, all of this sources from decisions that are made at the economic political levels, where, you know, it's decisions to bomb Libya to smithereens that creates a refugee crisis, or it's the decisions of the Italian government to issue these temporary visas that creates the possibility for these migrants to flood through, or it's Turkey or Saudi Arabia or these other places that you would think would be a more natural destination for these Muslim refugees, but no, they're heading to Europe. And again, that has to do with decisions that are made at political levels. So we have to keep that in mind. But certainly the narrative that ultimately ends up emerging in the public debate is, well, it's these Muslims that are ruining everything, or from the Muslim perspective, I guess, oh, you know, these Europeans are just racist. And it creates and fosters those tensions. And I think it's, yeah, that the resolution of those tensions is going to come, again, through the same political process that created the problem in the first place. But that will probably fly under the radar.
It's certainly a strange situation, because I'm inclined to understand this as evidence of the New World Order trying to establish one world government. Ultimately, they're going to start with creating regions like the European Union that will become, in theory, a single nation rather, or a single administrative district rather than a collection of individual nations. The same thing is the North American Union, where Mexico, the United States, and Canada become one entity rather than three separate countries. And eventually these entities, they evolve into, they have their associations, and the North American Union becomes part of the European Union and so on. So if that were true, aren't they rolling the dice right now and taking a big chance in Europe? What happens if one or two nations just say, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm not going to play this game anymore? And that's not inconceivable, at least not to me. Now what happens? Have we lost? Is it a step backward for the New World Order? Does the European Union divide? Or does it coalesce into a single, a stronger administrative region? Are they risking this?
Yes. That's an extremely insightful and perceptive question. But you're breaking up a little bit on my side. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. Well, that's such an important question. And I think the way that we should look at this, yeah, absolutely, whenever there is a crisis situation of any sort, it's always a rolling of the dice. There's always that liquefaction that has to take place in order for a new system to be cemented into place. And in that moment of kind of tipping the chessboard over, certainly there's room for something to go awry or to go askew. But we have to look at this as not just something that's developing kind of willy-nilly here in 2015. It's something that's been developing for decades now, and they've been sort of putting the framework for this into place. So you look back into the 1990s, where, of course, Samuel P. Huntington wrote the book that predicted, quote-unquote, this era, the Clash of Civilizations, which, of course, is the Clash of Civilizations and the remaking of World Order, which stems from a article that was originally published in Foreign Affairs, the journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. So we know where this entire framework is coming from, and the way that it's been inculcated in the public consciousness now for decades. They kind of prepped us in the 90s, and then we saw the spectacular events of 9/11, and then the war on terror narrative. So now everything is taking place in this narrative that's been developed for us. It is now the Muslims versus Western culture, which further reinforces the idea. I mean, for example, now you see, even amongst the people who are revolting against what the European Union's response to this has been so far, their response is framed in the terms of, well, we are Europeans, this is European culture, and this Muslim culture is invading our culture. It certainly fosters the nationalist side of things, but in an international context. I mean, I think when you get those sort of nationalist elements reacting to this in that European context, they're reacting in a way that frames it as, well, this is Europe for Europeans. They're starting to identify themselves as European more so than they had in the past. And I think this is all part of a very, very large game that's being played right now. So, yes, it does, it in some ways it does and it can work against the idea of forming sort of, you know, a global government. But I think it further reinforces the regional identity, which has to be the next step. I don't think you go from national governments to a global government. I think you go from national to regional to global.
I agree with
that. So I think it's just part of a process that's unfolding right now.
Get on to another subject here a little bit. All right, do you follow Bitcoin at all, the cryptocurrencies?
I do. I don't follow the day-to-day price, but I do have some Bitcoin that people have donated to me over the years.
All right. I've got a headline here from Cointelegraph, which is a magazine, an internet magazine that just deals with the future of money, Bitcoin in particular. And the headline is, China unofficially authorizes Bitcoin, price turns bullish. Is China really going to allow Bitcoin within China? And if so, what effect is that likely to have? Is that going to make Bitcoin give it more traction than it already has, or much ado about nothing?
Well, it is important, I would say, for the price of Bitcoin, if nothing else, because in that run-up, a couple of years ago to the $1,000 plus that it reached at its peak, a lot of the buying that was at that time was coming from China. And that was before there was a somewhat semi kind of crackdown by China, which restricted the amount of buying that was taking place there. And then we, of course, saw the that sort of Bitcoin bubble burst. So I think if this report is true, and I haven't looked into this, so I don't really know, you know, to what extent this is reflecting something, you know, important that's just changed. But if it is, I would say that that's important for Bitcoin. And from what I understand, Bitcoin has been on its way up in the last few days quite dramatically. So perhaps this is related to that. And certainly it seems that people in China are interested in ways around the Chinese banking system and around currency controls that exist there. So it shouldn't be surprising, I think, that the Chinese public would be interested in trying to get around that, whether that's through precious metals, which we know they're buying at record rates in recent years, or something like cryptocurrency.
The idea behind, it says China unofficially authorizes Bitcoin. The article is telling us that China has reversed its position, essentially. Instead of trying to prevent Bitcoin from gaining traction in China, they're just saying, all right, leave it alone. We're not going to mess with it. If they do it, they do it, and then we're not going to go after anyone, at least not at this time. Is this evidence that China has decided if you can't beat them, join them? Is it possible that they've just conceded that Bitcoin can't be stopped, and therefore let's stop regulating it?
It would be strange for China to make such an admission, even tacitly, mm-hmm. considering the entire point of the Cyberspace Administration of China is to try to control the internet and everything that flows through it. So you would think they would at least believe that they could control it if they wanted to, which has to make you wonder if there are ulterior motives for this.
Yeah.
And I can only speculate what those ulterior motives are, but I can't believe that the Chinese government really believes or wants the public to believe they believe that they can't control it.
What do you think the future of these cryptocurrencies might be? Are these going to catch on, or will the governments of the world try to stamp them out, or will the governments of the world try to co-opt them and say, okay, we're good, we can have cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin, for example, but the central bank of the Federal Reserve is going to run it, or the central bank of the European Union or whatever. What do you think the future is of the digital currencies?
Bingo. I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's probably the most likely thing, that either they're going to start national blockchains that are administered by central banks, or they're going to form, or they're already starting to form foundations to try to, you know, make Bitcoin more acceptable to the public, easier for people to use. But of course, it will also mean that it will become part of the existing banking infrastructure, where, of course, the key underlying point of the idea of the blockchain technology is that you no longer need bank middlemen to do all sorts of transactions that you did in the past. So I think, like so many other things, the idea, the kernel of the idea, is revolutionary, but it's going to be sold to the public in a way that is fundamentally not revolutionary. And that's why I think perhaps China might be backing off at this point, because they want to control the beast rather than just to try to outlaw it, which will only create a black market for it.
We're out of time, James. I want to thank you for being on the program. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Look forward to talking to you again next Thursday, actually Wednesday night, and program will be broadcast on Thursday. Thank you, folks, for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.